This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Life's Too Short to Go So Fucking Slow, Lessons from an Epic Friendship That Went the Distance, by Susan Lakey. Narrated by Amy McFadden. Introduction. Running is for crazy people. Running is for crazy people. I stubbed out my cigarette and continued ranting to myself. There's no reason to run unless someone is chasing you. Those people are like a cult. They're brainwashed into being completely absorbed by this lifestyle. They even get tattoos after doing a race to declare they were initiated into that stupid cult. It's ridiculous. Never mind that those people were my friends. Sure, I loved them. But let's be clear. I loved them despite the fact that they were always exercising and doing triathlons and eating weird foods. I just didn't get it. Any of it. And though I knew they weren't trying to talk with an air of superiority, when they shared how they'd just gotten back from a 2-hour bike ride or a 10-mile run, I still somehow felt judged, the outsider who preferred happy hour to spin class. 10 miles? At 23 years old, tired, stressed, and overweight, I couldn't fathom walking 1 mile, much less running 10. I knew my unhealthy habits were wrong, but I found ways to justify them. Smoking caused lung cancer, yes, but it alleviated my stress. That made it all right in my book. Alcohol? My rational mind knew I wasn't going to find answers to life's problems at the bottom of a bottle. Yet at the end of every stressful workday, I poured myself a drink to unwind, and another one to help me forget the day, then another to help me sleep. As for exercise, I certainly didn't have time for that. As a first-year college professor with a demanding boss, I had too much work to do. And although I frequented fast food chains, who had time to cook, at least I usually chose a salad, with extra ranch dressing. Sure, a big gulp of Diet Dr. Pepper was my constant companion, but that was because I needed the caffeine to keep me going and the carbonation to quell the nausea from last night's tequila. I had gained 40 pounds in the span of a year. My marriage of 4 months was beginning to unravel at the seams, as was I. I questioned whether the decision to move from Wisconsin to Arizona to take my first teaching job had been the right one. It was too much change, too much pressure, and I felt unprepared to handle it. One day, I was smoking outside my office when my boss came up to me and pointed at the cigarette in my hand. "Mind if I have a drag?" he queried. I was shocked. Aside from a curt welcome on my first day on campus, Dr. Nunez had never spoken directly to me. I was perfectly fine with that. I found everything about him intimidating, from the way he leaned back in his chair to stare at people while they were talking, to his daily disappearances at lunchtime to swim laps in the campus pool. As an engineering professor, he had a bias toward technical and analytical brains that he did not try to hide. When he had been assigned to oversee some majors within the social sciences, which included mine, his irritation had been unmistakable. "Why?" he'd lamented. "It's not even a real science." Physically, he was a regimented, imposing figure with long limbs and muscled arms, which he liked to cross over his chest. I was convinced that he had been placed on this earth to intimidate the hell out of me. I did everything I could to avoid crossing his path. Yet there he was, sitting in a cloud of my Marlboro Light smoke, with outstretched fingers.
"Well?" Dr. Nunez smiled. Dr. Nunez knew how to smile?
Shocked, I handed him my cigarette and watched as he took it between his fingers and stared expectantly at the wisp of smoke curling up from around his knees. He lifted the cigarette, smiled at me once more, and stubbed it out in the nearby ashtray.
"You don't need that shit."
He stood up and extended his hand.
Come on, let's go get some coffee. I was infuriated. That was my last smoke, I wanted to yell. Instead, I sat dumbfounded in the shade cast by Dr. Nunez's broad shoulders, too stunned by his bold gesture to say anything.
I said, Dr. Nunez sighed with obvious irritation, let's go get some coffee.
I quickly scrambled to my feet. Okay. Over Americanos, Dr. Nunez asked a lot of questions. Why do you smoke? If smoking makes you less stressed, what's making you so stressed in the first place? He listened to my answers intently, interjecting an occasional nod and a hmm. His demeanor was disarming, and I felt it drawing me in. Despite knowing better, I found myself committing the incredibly unprofessional crime of unloading all my personal problems on my boss. During a pause in the conversation, I felt a sudden wave of regret. What was I thinking, spilling all this, and to Dr. Nunez of all people? But, to my surprise, he didn't lecture me. Instead, he tipped his head thoughtfully, pursed his lips, and said matter-of-factly,
"You should come swimming with me during lunch tomorrow."
I laughed out loud. I couldn't help it.
"Listen, sir," I said once I'd composed myself, "that's very nice, but I'm not one of those people."
"Those people?"
"Crazy people. Health nuts," I blurted out before realizing I had most likely offended the man who signed my paycheck.
"Come on," he scoffed.
"Swimming is fun. But don't take my word for it. You should try it for yourself."
When I hesitated, he added,
"If nothing else, you'll get a good suntan out of it."
Did I mention that sunbathing was one of my vices, too? The next day, as planned, Dr. Nunez showed up at my office door at 11:45 on the dot. Slung over his shoulder was a bag of kickboards and swim paddles.
"You ready?"
I nodded meekly, hoping I was feigning enthusiasm convincingly. He smiled and nodded toward the exit.
"Let's go."
I went swimming that day. And the next, and the next. At first it was out of fear of offending my boss, but soon I found myself starting to look forward to it. I wasn't fast, but I was capable, and I liked spending an hour each day in the Arizona sunshine. In between laps, Dr. Nunez became Carlos, and Carlos became my friend. It didn't make sense. An athletic, accomplished guy like him had no reason to take an interest in a slow, chubby kid who made poor choices. Still, I decided not to question it. Over the span of our 10-year friendship, my unhealthy vices disappeared one by one. Cigarettes were eventually replaced with running. Stress was hammered out on the pedals of a bike, and big gulps of Diet Dr. Pepper and tequila were replaced with post-ride Americanos with my new mentor. I didn't realize it at the time, but that Marlboro Light break outside my office building essentially upended my life, changing it forever. I could easily tell you, in boring detail and with tedious data sets, all about how I became one of those people I had long derided. I could tell you what workouts I did to set a personal best time in the marathon or finish my first Ironman. I could suggest what you should eat or drink or wear. But that's not the real story. Running and triathlon didn't transform me. My friendship with Carlos Nunez, cemented in 100-degree trail runs and Sunday morning bike rides, did. Chapter 1. Oh my God, I'm friends with a crazy person. On paper, our friendship didn't make a lot of sense. Carlos was a Mexican immigrant who had worked his way out of poverty to achieve the American dream. I was a white kid from the Midwest who took that American dream for granted. He was an imposing figure, with broad shoulders, a trim waist, a shaved head, and a confident swagger. I was 40 pounds overweight and forgot to comb my hair most mornings. He taught engineering, I taught human development. He was 42, I was 23. He had his shit together, I most assuredly did not.
Really, there was no reason for the two of us to ever interact beyond his responsibilities as my boss. As the chair of the Technology and Consumer Sciences Department of our college, he only needed to conduct my teaching evaluations once a year. And yet, every day, he would appear in the doorway of my office, duffel bag in hand.
"Let's go!"
It wasn't a request. We'd walk across the campus together, my short shuffle rushing to keep up with his long strides.
"How are you?"
he'd ask.
"I'm good,"
I'd say.
"Yeah? Yeah?"
And then he'd wait, intentionally creating pockets of silence in the conversation, which drove me crazy. I would panic in the quiet, looking for something, anything, to fill the void. I'd blather on about a lecture that hadn't gone well, rehash a discussion I'd had with a colleague, or share that I hadn't slept well the night before. If all else failed, the weather was my go-to. Anything to avoid another second of uncomfortable silence. It was a relief when we crossed paths with a colleague or student. Where most people simply exchanged hellos in passing, Carlos would stop, greet the person by name, and ask, "How are you?" Then he'd wait patiently for the answer. The more time I spent with Carlos, the more I realized that my initial perception of him, a cold, intimidating, silent figure, had been dead wrong. I had been cowering in my office, trying to avoid crossing his path, and everyone else on campus seemed to go out of their way to place themselves in it. A half-mile walk across campus sometimes took 20 or 30 minutes. I didn't understand it. Carlos didn't have a particularly effusive personality. His expression usually remained the same whether his conversation partners were sharing news of a promotion, a death in the family, or the pastrami sandwich they'd had for lunch. Furthermore, he never, ever disclosed anything about himself in return. I was spending an hour of my day, every day, with someone I knew nothing about. When it came to communication, I was an open book and he was Fort Knox. It drove me absolutely crazy. So one day, I decided to give him a taste of his own medicine.
"Hey,"
I barked as I knocked on his office door one day.
"How are you?"
He looked up from his computer with a puzzled expression. Normally, he was the one standing in my office door. The new dynamic concerned him.
"Are you okay?"
"Yes, I'm great." I sat down across the desk from him, leaning back in the chair with my arms folded.
"How about you?"
"How are you?" Carlos laughed uncomfortably.
"Are you sure you're okay?"
"Yeah."
"Yeah?"
We sat there in silence, Carlos meeting my aggressively uncomfortable eye contact with a baffled stare. I was going to wait him out. 20 seconds passed. I was going to win this battle. A minute. I would push down my discomfort, embrace the silence, and...
"Yah!"
I finally snapped, unable to stand the quiet any longer. "I don't understand! How do you just sit there without talking?" Carlos leaned back in his chair, clearly amused to have won a battle of wills he didn't even know he had entered. His aloofness was grating to my psyche. "You know what's sad?" I said impulsively. "You're the closest thing I have to a friend here in Arizona." It was the truth. My friends were 2,000 miles away in Wisconsin. Since the move to Arizona, my work hadn't left me with much time to socialize, aside from the hour I spent quietly swimming in the lane next to my boss. Carlos cocked his head, not sure what to make of this.
Thank you?
"And I know nothing about you. Nothing. You ask all these questions about me and never offer up anything about you in response." Carlos quietly considered what I was saying, putting up a hand to shush me every time I tried to populate his silence with further prattling. At last he spoke.
"Well," he said matter-of-factly, "you never asked."
I scoffed with disbelief. Of course I had asked.
Hadn't I?
I shuffled through my memories of our interactions, searching for evidence of my reciprocal interest in Carlos's life.
"It's okay, Susan," Carlos said when I became flustered. "Most people like to talk about themselves. There are a lot more talkers than there are listeners. You're a talker, and I'm a listener."
I believed his words were meant to be reassuring, but I couldn't help feel like a self-involved sack of shit. My default setting to fill the silence was always to yammer on about myself. It had never occurred to me to give him the same opportunity. My head was so far up my own ass, it was a miracle I ever saw daylight. Sensing my growing self-loathing, Carlos gestured to the bag of M&Ms poking out of my briefcase on the floor.
"Hey, toss me one of those."
I complied, chucking the package across the office. In one fluid motion, Carlos caught the bag and returned it in my direction.
"No, open the bag and toss me one."
I looked at him, confused.
"What, one piece?"
He nodded. I opened the bag and shook out a single colored candy. With an underhanded toss, I launched it into the air. Carlos wheeled his desk chair under the candy and caught it neatly in his mouth.
"There,"
he said, chewing with a satisfied smile.
"Now you know my secret talent."
I chuckled, tossing him another candy. He leaned back in his chair and caught it.
"What else do you want to know?"
I thought for a second. "What do you do for fun?"
"Nuh-uh,"
Carlos admonished, pointing at the bag of M&Ms. I dug another candy out of the bag and arced it across the office. He pushed off with his feet, wheeling his chair to arrive beneath the candy just in time.
"I swim with you,"
he answered, as he bit down on the chocolate.
"Nice attempt at flattery, sir," I laughed. "What else do you do?"
Another candy sailed through the air.
"I ride my bike. I run."
"Why?"
"More candy." "I do Iron Man."
"What's that?"
"It's a race."
"What kind of race?"
"A very long one."
Suddenly, I recalled him coming to work one Monday earlier that year, sunburned and limping. I hadn't asked him about it, but later that day, one of my colleagues had said he'd fainted in the faculty lounge. His wife, Diane, had been dispatched to drive him home.
"Was that because of Iron Man?" I asked.
Carlos chuckled.
"Yeah, from now on, I'm skipping work the day after the race."
When I pressed for more information, Carlos turned his computer monitor in my direction and pulled up a website about the Ironman triathlon. I dropped the M&Ms bag on the desk and leaned over to read the event description. My jaw dropped. A 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, and a 26.2-mile run all in the same day? I had so many questions.
"Isn't that hard?"
"Sometimes."
"How long does it take you?"
"On a good day, about 10 hours.
"Are you fucking nuts?"
"Depends on who you ask." "So, wait," I paused, trying to make sense of what I was hearing. "You mean to tell me you suffer for 10 hours?
"Yes."
"Like major suffering?"
"Uh-huh,"
Carlos nodded.
"And you do this voluntarily?
For fun?"
"Yup."
"That doesn't sound like fun. That sounds like pain." His eyes widened.
"The pain is the best part. It lets you know you're alive."
I scanned his face for any sign of sarcasm. There was none. This guy was actually serious. I could only shake my head and laugh.
"With all due respect, sir, I think you're crazy." "I'm also hungry,"
he said, dangling the empty bag of M&Ms, which he had finished while I was distracted by the Iron Man website.
"Let's order a pizza."
Chapter 2. When the Shit Hit the Fan. Shortly after our first anniversary, my husband asked for a divorce. In hindsight, I should have seen it coming. For the last few months of our marriage, we were either arguing or avoiding each other altogether. We got married because it was time. In our rural Wisconsin town, it was expected. Love,
marriage, babies as soon as possible. Even for those who went off to college, it was generally expected that a mortarboard at graduation would quickly be exchanged for a bridal veil. As a result, the decision to extend my education had not been made without criticism. "Don't you want to settle down?" my friends and family asked when I announced that I would attend graduate school immediately after finishing my undergrad coursework. "Have the wedding, buy a house, have a few rugrats running around. You can always go back to school when they're older." I wanted to want those things. My friends were planning elaborate weddings and discussing family sizes, and I sometimes felt left out. My college boyfriend came from a large, tight-knit clan with traditional values, and I wanted so badly to belong. I wasn't particularly keen on the idea of babies, but everyone assured me that I would change my mind when I spawned a few of my own. So when my boyfriend asked me to marry him, I decided to get with the program. 2 weeks after I finished graduate school, I donned the requisite bridal veil and said I do at the obligatory elaborate wedding. Love and marriage, check. It was time to settle down. A month after our wedding, I accepted a position as a professor in Phoenix and moved across the country with my new husband. Our first night in our new house was also our first fight as a married couple. We fought every day for the next year. Small-town Wisconsin was vastly different from big-city life in Arizona. I loved the bustle and unpredictability of Phoenix. My husband hated it. I loved my new job and the long hours of challenging work. My husband struggled to find a job he enjoyed. I felt like I finally fit in somewhere. My husband stuck out like a sore thumb. He came to Arizona to settle down and start a family. I couldn't shake the feeling that I had just settled. I was convinced that something was wrong with me. If I just tried harder, I'd be happier. If I didn't work so much, he wouldn't be so unhappy. If I lost the extra weight I had gained after our wedding, he'd be nicer to me. Surely I was doing something wrong. "I think I made a giant mistake," I blurted out one day while walking to the pool with Carlos. He looked at me with concern, the first time anyone had done that in months, and the levee of tears and anger and frustration broke. As tears began to stream down my face, Carlos took my arm and steered me back to my office.
"What's going on?"
He closed the door behind him and pulled a handful of tissues from the box on my desk.
"I laid it all out. The fighting, the self-doubt, the unshakable feeling of failure.
Even admitting feeling like a failure made me feel like a failure. Mostly, I cried." Carlos just sat there, listening and handing me tissues until I ran out of things to say.
"So what do you want?"
Carlos asked. I didn't know. It was the first time anyone had asked me that question. I hesitated, then replied with what seemed like the appropriate answer. Marriage, house, children. To even consider wanting anything other than that small-town bucket list of my youth felt blasphemous. Carlos shook his head and inquired again.
"No, not what everyone else wants. What do you want? You're allowed to decide, you know."
I didn't know. It would be a while before I really would. My husband, convinced that a return to small-town Wisconsin would fix our big-city fights, persuaded me to move back to our home state for the sake of our marriage. We were happy in Wisconsin, he said, and we desperately wanted to be happy again. As the spring semester wrapped up on campus, I walked into my boss's office and handed him a letter. Carlos read my 2 weeks' notice and looked up with a disappointed stare. After an awful silence, he said,
"Is this what you want?"
"It is."
"Is it really?"
"Yes." This was not a lie. Well, not entirely. I wanted to want it.
"I don't believe you," he said frankly, "but I support you. If you change your mind, please know that you always have a job here."
"Thank you, sir."
I walked hastily out of his office and made a beeline for my car, where I sobbed for an hour. My husband got us to Wisconsin as quickly as possible, taking only what we could fit in our car. We abandoned any souvenir from our first year of marriage in Arizona. As it turned out, we fought the first night in our new apartment in Wisconsin, too, and every night thereafter. The stress of the move only escalated our struggles, and a few weeks after our second cross-country move in the span of a year, my husband demanded a divorce. I felt defective. Everyone around me had made love, marriage, babies seem so easy, and I had managed to screw it up in spectacular fashion. But I also felt free. For some reason, defective didn't feel as terrible as I thought it would, and certainly not as bad as I had been feeling up to now. If I finally accepted that I didn't fit the love, marriage, babies mold, maybe I could actually start creating a life that suited me. I was a rebel, a nonconformist, a devil-may-care divorcee, damn it. And even though I still wasn't sure what I wanted, I was going to allow myself to look for the answer. The divorce papers were signed at 10 a.m. on a Thursday morning. I was on the front porch of my apartment by noon, drinking champagne straight from the bottle, when my laptop chimed with a new message alert. "Today is the beginning of great things for you," Carlos had written. "Go where you want and do what you want. Use this to get started with your new life." Attached to the email was voucher information for the purchase of an airline ticket. "I'm on my way," I typed in reply, smiling as I took another swig from my champagne bottle. Chapter 3. The Anti-Diet Success Story. I only took up running because I wanted to shrink my fat ass. There, I said it. There's an unspoken agreement among runners that we're not supposed to talk about running as a tool for weight loss. We're supposed to do it for the endorphins, or fall in love with the journey, or other such motivational poster crap. But honestly, a lot of runners started in the sport because they looked in the mirror and saw something jiggle. I had a lot of jiggly parts. After my divorce, I came down with a bad case of the not-enoughs. I had tried and failed at marriage. Despite my best efforts, I had hard evidence of my inadequacy as a wife, and I extrapolated that to all areas of my life. Not pretty enough, intelligent enough, nice enough, industrious enough, funny enough, congenial enough. To compensate for my shortfalls, I overcompensated. I returned to Arizona and threw myself into work, spending more hours on campus than ever before. I enrolled in a doctoral program, pulling frequent all-nighters to write the perfect papers and finish the perfect dissertation. I said yes to every work assignment and accepted every social invitation. Whether at a meeting or a party, I was always the first to arrive and the last to leave. In fear of letting down another person with my not-enoughs, I strove to be everything to everyone. It was exhausting. I tried and tried, yet I never felt satisfied. Every time I walked past a mirror, I'd groan and look away. I hated the way I looked, the way my belly mounded and my pants strained to contain my thighs. In addition to all my other shortcomings, I was not thin enough. I added that to my list of self-improvement projects for the future. Maybe I would start swimming with Carlos again. I hadn't been to the pool since returning to Arizona. "What the fuck is this?" Carlos scoffed at lunch one day, taking from my hands the shaker bottle I was sipping, filled to the brim with neon yellow fluid. "Give that back!" I exclaimed, scrambling to retrieve the single component of my lunch. "It's my weight loss shake!" His disdain for the weight loss industry was no secret. "All you have to do," he'd say whenever I bemoaned my weight, "is stop putting crappy food in your face hole and do a little bit of fucking exercise. It's not that hard." I was quick to point out that he had never been overweight in his life. He had no idea just how hard it really was. I knew. I had tried everything to lose weight. A week on a diet that consisted solely of diet soda and apples, a few miserable days on the master cleanse, an attempt at a cabbage soup diet that ended with the first disgusting bite, diet pills and laxatives, restricting myself to 500 calories per day for a week, only to lose my resolve on Donut Friday in the office. I had taken every magic pill and read up on every secret diet, and yes, I could confirm that losing weight was hard. It was really, really hard.
"It's not," Carlos maintained. "You just need to find some physical activity that you enjoy doing every day. Weight loss is secondary. You really want to drink that crappy shake every day?"
I did not want to drink that crappy shake every day. Carlos launched a campaign to get me to try running. Each day he'd email me another article aimed at beginner runners, and each day I'd assert that I was not a runner. I did not like running, nor was I any good at running. Furthermore, I associated running with elementary school gym class, where we'd been forced to run the mile once a year while our gym teacher, Mrs. Morey, stood atop a hill with a megaphone and blared, "Yay, eagles! Boo, turkeys!" That experience had scarred this little turkey for life.
"Just try it," Carlos insisted. "I know you. You're going to be hooked."
"Running is hard," I whined.
"That's exactly why I think you'll like it. You need the challenge."
Grudgingly, and maybe just to prove him wrong, I decided to try things his way. At the gym one day, I hopped on the treadmill and turned the dial to a slow jog. In just a few minutes, I turned the dial back to a walk, red-faced and puffing. Yep, it was confirmed. I did not like running. I was not good at running. It was hard, and I felt inadequate. Yet again. But, like everything else in my life, the realization of this inadequacy led to overcompensation. I signed up for a 5K race. To prepare, I measured out a 3-mile route with my car and ran it every day, like a trained circus pony wearing a rut in the dirt. But quite unexpectedly, I found myself looking forward to this daily routine. The more I ran, the easier it got. Perhaps running wasn't so bad after all. When I crossed the finish line of that first 5K, I was bursting with pride. I couldn't wait to tell Carlos, who I knew would share my celebration. Drunk with endorphins, I fired off a text with my finishing time and waited, giddily, for his response.
45 minutes for a 5K? My phone buzzed with his all-caps reply. What did you do, skip?
Perhaps I had chosen the wrong person for a celebration. His callous reaction was crushing. I was not good enough. But I had to admit it was provocative, too. I vowed to improve. The goalposts moved with every race, training at a faster pace, then running a 5K under 30 minutes, then running 5-mile stretches in my workouts, then finishing a 10K race. Finishing lines became starting points for new ambitions. I signed up for a half marathon. As each goal was accomplished, I slowly came to believe I was capable of accomplishing other, bigger goals. I felt a definitive and unfamiliar sense of empowerment growing with each mile run and each finish line crossed. And just as Carlos had predicted in the face of my snide disbelief, along the way, I lost the weight, and then some. Almost 70 pounds in a span of 4 years. But I didn't stick with running for the weight loss. I did it for the endorphins, fell in love with the journey, and all that other inspirational crap runners talk about. As it turns out, those really are the best reasons to run. There was no magic pill. There was no secret diet. There was just me and the work I was willing to do. For once, finally, that was more than enough. Chapter 4. Anyone can do an Ironman? Every now and then, my work would take me to cool places, presenting at a conference in New Orleans during Mardi Gras or consulting for a research project in Los Angeles. Other times, I'd travel to really exotic locales, like glamorous Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Technically, my meetings were taking place in Spokane, but a major basketball tournament had booked all the hotel rooms in town. My accommodations were 30 minutes away in a motel straddling an isolated stretch of the Washington-Idaho border. I was not thrilled.
"Wait a second,"
Carlos jumped in when I mentioned the upcoming trip.
"When are you going?"
"Sometime in June, I think."
"Holy shit," Carlos said, laughing. "I'm going there in June, too."
As it turned out, Carlos was racing his 10th Ironman in Coeur d'Alene the weekend after my work trip. Suddenly, Idaho didn't seem so bad. I decided to extend my trip to spend the weekend. I wanted to finally witness this Ironman spectacle Carlos had talked about for so long. The morning of the race, I drove out to Lake Coeur d'Alene, where the swim would take place. I walked to the lake shore, expecting to spot Carlos in the water. Instead, I was greeted by a mass of humanity in identical black wetsuits. I didn't know how many there were. More than 1,000, for sure. Possibly 2,000. I was floored. There were actually that many people insane enough to do this race? I had always thought Carlos was one of a handful of nut jobs. The crowd buzzed with a quiet energy that grew as the sun emerged over the horizon. Something electric was definitely in the air. All around me, there were hugs and high fives and good luck kisses before an announcer boomed through a microphone that the triathletes should take their marks. "Today, you are an Ironman." Goosebumps prickled the skin on my arms. The start cannon fired, and I watched the pack move into the water. I studied the expressions of the swimmers, determined, focused, even joyful. The spectators cheered wildly when they spotted friends and family members emerging from the water. I found myself cheering, too. I had no choice but to go along with it. I was overwhelmed. It was honestly so goddamned exciting. I watched, riveted, for 5 more hours as the bikes looped through town. How could they stay upright for 112 miles? Carlos flew past me on his way to the transition area between the bike and run, flashing me a wave and an easy smile. Then the rain came. As athletes made their way onto the run course for the 26.2-mile run, the sky opened up and drenched Coeur d'Alene with cold, heavy, unrelenting rain. I asked a spectator if they would cancel the race due to the storm. She looked at me oddly. "Why would they do that? This is Ironman." It was confirmed. This sport made absolutely no sense. These athletes actually were insane. But I was impressed. I bought a poncho from a gas station and sat on the curb, awed, as I watched one athlete after the next run by. "What are you doing out here?" Carlos yelled when he spotted me on the curb near the halfway point of his run. "Go inside!" "No way!" I shouted back. I wanted to cheer until my voice was hoarse and clap until my hands hurt. It was a lot easier than what he was doing. Runners came through the finish chute, wrapped in Mylar blankets to stave off the cold. Some fell to the ground, shivering and spent, after crossing the finish line. Some laughed, some cried, some just looked to the sky in amazement. I had never seen such pure displays of emotion. And then there was Carlos, making his way through the downpour with a giant grin. Something about him was different. I couldn't place my finger on it, but I could tell those 10 hours had changed him. I was overwhelmed with respect and astonishment as he gave high fives to spectators on the sidelines and let out an energetic whoop of joy as he crossed the finish line. The race seemed to have given him an injection of vibrancy I had never seen before. But how? The race itself, 140 miles in total, would beat most people down. The weather conditions certainly added to the suffering. Then I recalled what Carlos had said the first time he'd told me about Ironman. "The pain is the best part. It's what lets you know you're alive." That was it. Carlos looked alive. Later that night, he spoke animatedly of the day's events as he devoured post-race pizzas and downed a victory beer. Strangers, noticing the finisher medal dangling from his neck, stopped to congratulate him as they walked past our table. They were impressed. So was I. "You're superhuman," I declared, shaking my head in disbelief. Carlos laughed dismissively. "Anyone can do an Iron Man, Susan. Anyone." I turned those words over and over in my head later that night in my hotel room. As the events of the day replayed in my head, I thought about conversations I'd had with various participants throughout the day, and realized the cast of characters really was diverse. They came in every shape, size, color, and age. There was a 70-year-old man doing his first Iron Man, a young woman celebrating her 18th birthday by doing the race, a mother of seven, a man who had lost more than 100 pounds while training for the race. Anyone can do an Iron Man? Anyone? I opened my laptop and typed in a search query for Iron Man races. "Nah, this is insane," I said out loud to no one in my darkened room. I hadn't even run a half marathon yet. I didn't know a damn thing about triathlon. What was I thinking, looking at Iron Man races? I shut the laptop and tried to force myself to catch a few hours of sleep before my early morning flight. Anyone can do an Iron Man. Anyone. I sat up in bed and opened the laptop again. Turned out there was a race in my home state of Wisconsin every September. I'd have just over a year to learn about triathlon. Anyone can do an Iron Man. Anyone. I wasn't crazy enough to do this, right? Anyone can do an Iron Man. Anyone. Count me in. Chapter 5. Shifting. You have got to be fucking kidding me. Normally, Carlos took a day or two to reply to emails. Sometimes he didn't reply at all. Which is why, when I forwarded my Iron Man Wisconsin confirmation email to Carlos, "Congratulations, you just signed away a year of your life and all of your disposable income," I was surprised to see my phone light up with his text only moments after sending the email. His skepticism took me aback. "No kidding, I'm in," I typed back. "Susan, this might be the dumbest thing you've ever done." I slumped in my chair, puzzled. That was not the reaction I'd expected. Shouldn't he be excited for me? Proud, even? After all, he was the reason I even cared about this sport in the first place. My phone buzzed again with a string of texts. "Have you swum in a lake? Are you comfortable riding a bike for long periods of time? Do you even have a bike?" How dare he rain on my parade with logic? I'd signed up for an Ironman triathlon. Surely he could muster up some enthusiasm. "You're supposed to be excited," I texted back. "Jesus Christ, Lakey! You don't have a bike, do you?" I bit my lip and seethed. "Sure I do." It wasn't a lie. I did have a bike. It was a mountain bike given to me by an ex-boyfriend for weekend trips to the bar. No longer would we need to designate a driver or call a cab for Sunday fun days with friends, he'd said animatedly. We had wheels, legal ones, ones that would mostly stay upright after $5 buckets of beer. So yes, I had a bike. Technically. My phone buzzed once more. "Well then, let's go for a ride next weekend." Damn it, he'd called my bluff. I didn't know much about triathlon, but I knew enough to know that my current good time ride wouldn't work. I opened my laptop and began typing frenetically. My Google searches for the next 48 hours had a common theme. Can I ride a mountain bike in Ironman? What bike should I ride for Ironman? Triathlon bike. Cheap triathlon bike. Discount triathlon bike. Do I have to have a tri-bike for Ironman? Road bike for triathlon. Cheap road bike. Discount road bike. Why are bikes so expensive? Ugh,
Bikes cost a lot of money.
It was bad enough that I'd had to borrow funds from my mom for the Iron Man registration fee. Now it seemed I would have to drop significant dough on the gear, too. I had a serious case of sticker shock. But it was Carlos's incredulity that rattled me to the core. How dare he call me out like that? He was supposed to be my friend, and friends support each other unconditionally. They don't laugh at big goals. Carlos was a jerk. I'd show him. I muttered obscenities under my breath as I started a new Google search. Credit card applications. 2 weeks and several $1,000s later, I drove to South Mountain, a nature preserve in Phoenix popular with cyclists, with a newly purchased bike in the trunk of my car. Carlos was waiting for me in the parking lot, leaning against his car with a smug smile.
"Well,"
he waved his hands with a flourish,
"let's see the bike."
"Sure," I said, feigning confidence. I opened the trunk of my car and wrestled the heap of metal and rubber onto the sidewalk. After hours of research online, I had decided my best bet for an affordable road bike was to purchase a used one. Following the measurements given on several cycling websites, I'd determined that my bike size was 54 centimeters. Only one had matched that size in a Craigslist search, a blue and white Specialized Tarmac road bike. The listing had a lot of information about components that made little sense to me, but sounded impressive nonetheless. I'd driven across town one evening to meet the seller in the parking lot of a shuttered Walmart.
"That looks good," I said when he showed me the bike. "I'll take it."
The seller's brow furrowed in confusion.
"Okay, but don't you want to ride it first?"
I took a few self-conscious laps around the empty parking lot with no idea what I should be looking for. The seller, sensing either naivete or idiocy, or maybe both, gave me a business card for a local bike shop with some scribbles on the back. Bike shoes, cleats, shorts, helmet, flat kit, pump.
"You'll need these," he said. "Go here and tell them I sent you. They'll give you a discount."
I gushed with gratitude, both for the stranger's kindness and for the new MasterCard in my purse. As it turned out, I needed both equally. In the parking lot at South Mountain, Carlos gave my new bike a thorough inspection, crouching low to peer at the mechanical parts connected to the rear wheel. He looked up and gave a slight nod of approval.
"Nice bike."
I puffed out my chest, relieved to have passed what I considered my first true test of Iron Man training. I knew Carlos was a bike snob. He often bragged about his own ride, a fancy black steed designed specifically for speed and efficiency in triathlon. "Nice bike" was high praise. Carlos clipped together the chin strap of his helmet and smiled.
"Shall we?"
We mounted our bikes and set off for a ride. I pedaled furiously, hoping I could keep my successful illusory streak going. I followed Carlos to San Juan Road, an out and back stretch within the South Mountain Preserve. I had run it several times before and knew the scenery well. 7 miles of soft, gradual downhills into a valley, then a return trip to climb out. On the run, the uphill was a challenge, but I assumed it would be easier on a bike. I assumed incorrectly. Pedaling downhill, my legs moved well, and I picked up considerable speed. After making the U-turn at the end of the road, however, it was quite the opposite. My pedals were suddenly lubricated with molasses, and my hamstrings were on fire as they tried to keep pace with Carlos, who was spinning effortlessly. He looked at my slow-moving feet.
"Why don't you shift down?"
My eyes widened. "No, I'm good, thanks."
"You don't look good. Shift down."
"Nah, I'm okay." The truth was, I didn't know how. I knew how to shift on my mountain bike, but it had numbered dials on the handlebars. This bike didn't have any dials. I wasn't sure what to do. My legs continued to burn, and I moved at a snail's pace. Although I couldn't see him, I could feel Carlos trying hard not to smile. It was really pissing me off.
You know what? Let's stop here for a second, he finally said.
We wove to the side of the road. My feet, shod in fancy new bike shoes that attached to the pedals, were stuck. At the start of the ride, the shoes had slid into the pedals with an effortless click, and I had assumed that unclipping would be the same motion, reversed. Again, I assumed incorrectly. Still attached to my pedals, I fell over with a crash and a curse. Carlos doubled over with laughter, unable to catch his breath.
God damn it, Lakey! He said between loud chortles. You really are an idiot.
My knee was skinned. The heel of my hand gushed blood. Hot tears stung my eyes.
God, I hated bikes. I hated Iron Man. I hated looking like an idiot. And I really hated Carlos Nunez.
Really? I huffed. All you've done since I signed up for Iron Man is make fun of me. You're supposed to be my friend. Why are you such a jerk?
I squirmed my way out from under the bike and sat in the gravel on the side of the road, hugging my knees.
Carlos sat down on the ground next to me, still chuckling.
Why are you upset?
You called me an idiot. Carlos, on the verge of laughter once more, took a moment to collect himself.
That's because you're acting like an idiot.
Seriously? I huffed. You're still choosing to be an asshole?
Tell me the truth, Susan.
He peered at me over the top of his sunglasses.
This is your first time riding this bike, isn't it?
I hesitated, then nodded, trying not to cry. I couldn't keep up the charade any longer. As we sat in silence, I was certain Carlos was crafting new and creative insults to my intelligence. I was also certain I deserved every one of them. But, to my great surprise, Carlos wrapped his arm around me and let out a heavy sigh.
You're really doing an Iron Man, huh?
I nodded again, the tears coming in full force. He was right. I was an idiot. Signing up for the race was the dumbest thing I had ever done.
What am I going to do? I wailed.
Well, he sighed, first lesson is figuring out how to ask for help. You'll need a lot of it if you're going to do an Iron Man. Carlos stood up, dusted the gravel off his shorts, and held out his hand to help me up.
Second lesson, how to ride a bike.
Chapter 6 Iron Man is hard. In the year leading up to Iron Man, Wisconsin, I immersed myself in every opportunity I had to learn about riding a bike. And running, and swimming, and how to put it all together to make an Iron Man. From my experience as a spectator at Coeur d'Alene, I had little to go on. Carlos chose to remind me of this often.
You have no clue what you've gotten yourself into, he'd say. Iron Man is hard.
For someone who derived such pleasure from this sport, he sure was full of doom and gloom. Instead of celebrating the things that were going right in my training, he'd pick apart my workouts and find something to improve. When things went wrong, he'd quiz me on what had happened, where things had gone south, what I should have done differently, and how I would keep it from happening again.
Oh, come on!
I protested one day, annoyed with the barrage of negativity.
Is it really necessary to look for the bad every time? I had a good bike ride today. Now buy me a coffee and tell me I'm awesome.
Buy your own coffee, Carlos snorted. Your ride wasn't as good as you think. Carlos never thought I was training hard enough. I thought he was a sadist. When high winds picked up in the desert, I'd rack my bike on an indoor trainer while he strapped on a helmet and headed outside. I thought covering 20 miles in a run was hard enough, but he insisted on plotting a course that crested every hill in Phoenix. He shoved his way into my lane of the pool during Master's swim, deliberately jostling me with every stroke. Ironman training was a boot camp of exasperation, made more infuriating by his constant refrain of, "You'll thank me for this later." Oh, I thanked him, repeatedly, with my middle finger high in the air. With 6 months to go before my first Ironman, Carlos headed to St. George, Utah, to race the Ironman distance for the 11th time. He insisted I come along. A group of our friends was racing, and he said I would take in a lot more from spectating this time around. I was now an Ironman in training, after all, not the casual observer I had been at Coeur d'Alene, and St. George presented an opportune chance to learn. At dinner the night before the race, excitement and nerves were high. Eager to be the best cheerleader possible, I went around the table, asking friends for their estimated splits for the swim, bike, and run. Having that information would help me find them on the course to cheer them on. Appreciative of the fan club, they volunteered their best guesses. Carlos, however, refused to estimate his splits. He said it was an impossible task, since too many things could go wrong during an Ironman.
"Here we go again," I groaned. "Always the optimist."
All Ironmans are hard, but Ironman St. George had a reputation for being particularly brutal. A cold water swim that could induce hypothermia, a bike ride with more than 14,000 feet of elevation gain, and a marathon with steep, unrelenting hills. To top it off, the weather forecast this year called for 100-degree temperatures and steady winds. It was going to be a beast of a race. So it wasn't surprising in the least when most of my friends came in well past their estimated times on the bike. The course and conditions were too hard to have a banner day. I was, however, surprised when Carlos still hadn't emerged, even after everyone else had come in. Of all our friends, Carlos was easily the strongest rider. He should have been first. When he finally appeared in the transition area, he dismounted from his bike and limped to the changing tent. Confused and a little worried, I waited for him to reappear.
"It broke!"
he yelled as he charged out of the tent and ran past me, still with a slight limp.
"What broke?"
I hollered to his back, but it was too late. He was gone, running his way to the first of 26-mile markers on the course. Soon our friends began to cross the finish line one by one, exhausted but elated. "Where's Carlos?" they all asked, expecting that he would have finished far ahead of any of them. They were shocked to learn he was still on the course. Something was wrong. We just didn't know what. Carlos eventually crossed the finish line, doling out high fives to spectators, per usual. But instead of making a beeline for the throng of friends awaiting him, he collapsed in the arms of a volunteer. Within seconds, he was shuttled off to the medical tent. We rushed to the structure, looking for any glimpse of Carlos through the openings.
"I see him!"
someone shouted excitedly, pointing to a cot in the back where Carlos was reclining. An IV was taped to one arm, pumping saline into his dehydrated body. The other arm was raised in the air in a thumbs-up gesture. A woozy grin was splashed across his face. We got the full story when he was finally cleared to join us for a post-race dinner. Halfway through the ride, the derailleur on his bike broke, leaving Carlos stuck in his hardest gear. On the steepest climbs of the bike course, pedaling was all but impossible. His strategy was to ride up the hills as far as he could, then dismount and run alongside his bike as he pushed it the rest of the way to the crest. The effort of pushing his hardest gear, combined with mile-long uphill sprints while wearing bike cleats, wrecked his legs. During the entirety of the marathon, Carlos said he felt like he was dragging two concrete bricks. Our group was aghast.
"Why the hell would you do that?"
we asked. Most people would have just quit when the bike broke. Although athletes are a stubborn bunch, clearly this level of obstinacy was new and unheard of, even among my experienced triathlete friends. But to Carlos, it was a ridiculous question. Why the hell wouldn't he do that?
"I came here for a fucking challenge, and I got one,"
he asserted pragmatically between ravenous bites of pizza. Carlos tipped the neck of his beer bottle at his rapt audience.
"This is what I trained for. Ironman is hard."
Suddenly, the Carlos Nunez sadistic approach to training made some sense. I was starting to discern that being a badass didn't mean performing well when conditions are just right. It was all about keeping your cool when everything goes wrong. And in Iron Man, as in life, a lot of things can go wrong. You can complain and quit, or you can make forward progress.